Your 125th anniversary summer. 125 years. That's a lot of trustees meetings. That's a lot of careful attention to the beauty and wonder of this place, a lot of rich history, a lot of wonderful memories, and I'm glad some of those memories over the years have been mine. Thank you so much for letting me come back. Melody asked me if I would say just a word about what I'm going to do at the Vespers tonight and at the Monday Musings tomorrow. At the Vespers tonight, I want to look at a passage in the book of Revelation. Now, a lot of people think the book of Revelation is kind of scary with beasts and dragons and weird imagery, but it's actually one of the most hopeful books in the Bible. And it ends with a marvelous scene. God's city, the New Jerusalem, comes down from heaven like a bride adorned for her husband. And we're going to take a little guided tour of God's city. I call the sermon tonight Urban Renewal. Now, tomorrow morning, I have been a teacher of preaching for over 45 years. I've just retired. And when I retired, I counted up, and I believe that in class, I have listened to over 40,000 sermons. I know that makes you envious. But most people say sermons are sermons, but they aren't. Sermons actually change style and fashion over the years, like the hems of women's skirts or neckties on men. And what I would like to do is to look at some of the changes that have occurred in preaching that impact the way we listen to sermons. For example, our Puritan forebears preached for an hour or two. I'm not going to do that this morning. Attention spans have contracted over the years with digital media and so on, and we're preaching today shorter and shorter, except for the first time in 200 years, in the last few years, sermons have started getting longer again. I'll talk about why that is and why it matters. So we'll be looking at changes in sermon fashion. Now, our scripture passage for this morning is from the 30th chapter of Deuteronomy. But before I read it to you, last week I was on the telephone with my dearest friend. We've been friends for nearly 50 years. We became friends in graduate school. He's retired, lives in Florida now, but we get on the phone once a week and talk for about an hour just to catch up with each other. And last week, I happened to say to him, I'm reading this fascinating book on the history of Ellis Island. Now, you know, Ellis Island is that small island in New York Harbor where from 1892 to 1954, 12 million immigrants came into the United States. My friend got very quiet, and then he told me something he'd never told me in 45 years. My father, he said, came through Ellis Island. He came as a little boy from Holland with his family. They immigrated here and came to Michigan, to Detroit, to make a new life for themselves in the new world. How many of us have stories like that? We're probably almost all of us here this morning. We're the descendants of immigrants. My own family came from Scotland through Ireland in the 1700s. They were Presbyterians, and they were trying to find religious freedom, and they settled in Pennsylvania and the Carolinas. I wonder what your family's story is. The reason I'm bringing this up is that this passage I'm about to read to you is a passage directed to immigrants. What has happened is the Hebrew people have been under the thumb of Pharaoh in Egypt, cruel and oppressive slavery. You know the spiritual, go down, Moses. Way down in Egypt land, tell old Pharaoh, let my people go. And sure enough, by the miraculous power of God, they escaped the thumb of Pharaoh into freedom. They went across the Red Sea and headed toward the border of the new land that God had promised them. But they had to go through a desert. Little water, little food, scorching sun, conditions so harsh that some of them begged to go back to Egypt. I'd rather die a slave than to perish here in the desert. But Moses trusted God, and God provided for them and took them to the border. And standing at the border, Moses makes one last speech. He said, "We're all assembled here. All of the leaders of the tribes, all the elders, all the men, the women, and the children, we're assembled here. We're about to cross the border into a new life and a new land. And I want to remind us who we are and whose we are. It's God who has brought us here. And God has a commandment to tell us this day. And this is what Moses said." Surely this commandment that God is commanding you today is not too hard for you, nor is it too far away. It's not in heaven that you should say, "Who will go to heaven for us and get it for us so that we might hear it and observe it?" Neither is it beyond the sea that you should say, "Who will cross to the other side of the sea for us and get it that we may hear it and observe it?" No, this word is very near to you. It's in your mouth and in your heart for you to observe. See, I have set before you today life and prosperity, death and adversity. If you obey the commandments of the Lord your God that I'm commanding you today by loving the Lord your God, walking in his ways, observing his commandments, decrees, and ordinances, then you shall live and become numerous, and the Lord your God will bless you in the land you are entering to possess. But if your heart turns away and you do not hear, but are led astray to bow down to other gods and serve them, I declare to you today that you shall perish. You shall not live long in the land you were crossing in the Jordan to enter and possess. I call heaven and earth to witness today. I have set before you life and death, blessings and curses. Choose life so that you and your descendants may live, loving the Lord your God, obeying him, holding fast to him, for that means life to you and length of days so that you may live in the land that the Lord swore to give to you and your ancestors, to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. Several years ago, a team of researchers doing some social research asked a representative sample of Americans this question: if you could go back to an earlier moment in your life and do something different with your life, would you? And what would it be? If you could roll back the clock and choose another path for your life, what would it be? Interestingly, most people said they would go back and make a change. Now, some people gave silly answers. They picked the correct Powerball number this time, or they would invest in Apple instead of GE. But most people took this quite seriously. One man said, for example, "If I could go back in time, I'd get to know my grandparents better. I realize now they were amazing and wonderful people, but as a teenager, I took them for granted, and now they're gone. I wish I had gotten to know them." One woman said, "If I could go back, I'd choose a different occupation. I would follow my passion this time, and I would take the risks, and I would be that artist that I've always dreamed of being." Another woman said, "I would go back to a day in the fourth grade when my classmates and I cruelly ganged up on a boy in our class who stuttered badly. I'm ashamed of what I did that day, and if I could go back, I would sit with him and listen to him with kindness. One man said, if I could go back, I would go to that father-daughter dance that I missed with my little girl. In fact, I missed a lot with my children. I was so focused on my work, and I would go back and enjoy my own children. Sometimes the answers turn tragic. One person said, if I could go back, I wouldn't get behind the wheel of my car after I had had a little too much to drink at the club that day. It cost a life. And I have thought so many times, God, can I change that? Can I change it? What would you do if you could go back in time and choose another path? I'm bringing this up because there is a deep sense in which this passage that I just read to us from the book of Deuteronomy is an invitation to go back in time and to redo things. Now, I told you it was a speech that Moses gave to the Hebrew children at the border when they were about to immigrate into the promised land. But this passage was actually written several hundred years later. It's written in retrospect. The people have already gone into the land. They've already made their decisions and their choices. They've set up a society and a nation. And not to put too fine a point on it, they have really messed up. They forgot the God who liberated them from Pharaoh and slavery. They chose greed and disobedience. They bowed down to the gods of Baal and the Canaanite gods, forgetting the living God. And as a result, the nation collapsed. The society fragmented. And now they have even been captured by the Babylonian army and taken as captives into exile. This is the lowest point in their national history, and it is right at this point that we have a God of second chances, that we have a God of redemption and hope who says, imagine that you're back at the beginning again. Listen to my commandment. I set before you life and death. Let's go back to the beginning and choose wisely. In a sense, it's sort of like a couple who've been married for 50 years, and on their 50th anniversary, they decide to renew their wedding vows. They've already raised the children. They've already spent decades together. There have been good times. There have been hard times. There have been times when speech was full of beauty and love and affection, and there have been times when speech was harsh and full of anger, like any marriage. And now, on their 50th anniversary, let's go back to the beginning and remind ourselves what is important, to love and cherish each other regardless of what comes. This passage is an invitation to do the same. Let's go back to the beginning, and we hear God setting out before us life and death. Now, I think we need this passage desperately today. I don't know whether you will agree with me or not, but I think we are in a time when our national soul is shaken and faltering, weary and compromised. We live in a society that's broken politically. We can hardly even talk to each other anymore. In fact, groups demonize all other groups, and the political process is paralyzed. We live in a culture that is infected with greed. The rich are getting richer, and the poor are getting poorer, to the point that many in our society don't see any hope of rising above the circumstances of poverty.